Tomorrow is the deadline for farmers to apply for Coronavirus Food Assistance Program 2. We're discussing COVID relief for farmers facing market disruptions, the impact of this aid, and what is needed next. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The USDA earmarked up to $14 billion in the second round of aid for producers. Farmers, how has the pandemic affected your farm finances? Have you lost clients? Are there gaps in your supply chain? It's 800-642-1234. Linda Seeler operates Hillside Dairy. It's an organic farm milking 50 cows, raising replacement heifers in Catawba in Price County. She's on the board of the Wisconsin Farmers Union representing District 1, which is 15 northern Wisconsin counties. Linda, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you.
Well, first, take us to your farm, if you will. Give us a snapshot of your operations.
We're a grass milk farm. We ship milk to Organic Valley. We are milking cows right now, as a matter of fact.
Thank you for letting us disrupt your morning.
No, I actually have a person here that works with me. So, yeah, it was good. I'm taking a few minutes off. We operate about, the farm itself is 198 acres, and we operate, lease, rent another 200 acres. So we make all of our own feed. So that keeps us plenty busy over the summer. And we are grazing anytime it's grazing season. We usually average about 165 days a year on an average season.
Yeah. Why organic? Why did you go this direction?
Well, we were conventional until I believe we began to transition probably around 2005. We were always kind of more organic than conventional. There were a lot of things that we just didn't do. It really suited our lifestyle and the farm that we're at. I mean, there's a lot of grass up in northern Wisconsin that is just available. It was just a really good fit for us. We like the way that the cows exercise. We like having them outside. We don't really like them confined all the time. They are confined somewhat in the winter in a freestall barn, but that's for their, you know, because the elements don't really allow them to be outside. But really the grazing lifestyle appealed to us. And if we were doing all those things anyway, we thought, well, we might as well just support the whole organic milking. There was a group of folks from Organic Valley that came up to our extension office and talked to a lot of farmers. They had a meeting probably around 2002, 2003. And at that point, we made the decision that we would go in that direction. And it's a decision that I certainly haven't regretted.
What has it been like for you in the pandemic?
Well, for one thing, I realized that in farming, I am already socially distant. That's one thing. I mean, I realize I do see people during the day, but very few. Because of farming needs, I'm usually home doing things that have to be done. I'm not out and about a lot.
Yeah.
As far as the pandemic itself impacting the farm, I know a lot of conventional farmers that were impacted. They had to dump milk at the beginning of the pandemic, and there are a lot of different milk companies that have had a COVID fee, if you will, taken out of the milk check. So I believe it has impacted them somewhat more. As far as our farm, we have just been very happy that as far as supply, Organic Valley, which does have a supply management chain, has been able to manage the amount of milk so it keeps all of our prices somewhat stable.
There hasn't been a huge disruption in your supply chain.
Not as much because if you think about it, there is more conventional milk in schools, yeah, restaurants, other things.
Right.
Usually when you go to a restaurant, if you're going to exclusively have organic food, then you've got organic milk served there. If you're going to a a regular restaurant or a food chain, you're not you don't really get the choice to have organic milk or not. You get the milk that's given with your meals. So that's why I believe it impacted organic farmers more. It was just the way that the supply chain was set up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Linda Seeler is with us, operates Hillside Dairy in Catawba, is a Wisconsin Farmers Union board member. We're looking at the economic effects of the pandemic through her farming operation, getting your perspective as well. Farmers, how has the pandemic impacted your farm and finances? Have you tried to adjust your business? Have you had to dump produce, milk, eggs? What was that like? 800-642-1234. Linda, there has been an immense pressure on dairy farms straight across Wisconsin and elsewhere to get bigger, right? To add to your head, to be able to keep your operations going and to turn a profit. What is that pressure like with you? I mean, you have 50 head of cattle. Do you feel that pressure to get bigger?
At times I do, because you're kind of in a unique group. You're so small not to be considered super important, but I believe our product that we produce here is important, just like every dairy farm is, irregardless of the size and the amount of manpower that it takes to run that farm. I would say that basically I was totally appalled when the Secretary of Agriculture made those remarks in Wisconsin. I thought back to Earl Butts and get bigger or get out. And I know a lot of small farms where people work really hard that were fighting, especially with conventional farms and the way the prices have been on a downhill cycle for the last 5 years. And people are really struggling here to get supply management to work for them, irregardless of what size farm they have. I think that that was a real big blow.
Yeah. When you look at the aid that has been offered to farmers in this crisis, the Wisconsin Farm Service Agency had said the coronavirus food assistance program has really helped farmers. How do you see this aid getting to people in your, you know, in your area, in your profession?
Well, the payments have been really timely and they've been appreciated. With this round two, there are more commodities covered than there were in round one. And I think that's a really positive thing. There isn't any farmer that really is just looking for a handout. You know, we're looking for stable prices. We're hoping for supply management so that we can have those stable prices. We're hoping that we don't continue to have an economic downturn as far as it has been for the last 5 years, because there's only so far a person can tighten their belt in any business. And our belts are about as tight as they can get. I do appreciate that this particular payment has been really timely. I had applied for it within the window and have already received it. And that, I think, is really a very good responsive thing. I know with the initial payments, I think there are more people, since there's only 1% of us that farm, most of the people can relate to the initial $1,200 that was granted to all of America. And there were a lot of people that did not receive those payments until later. And this particular round of payments has been extremely timely and I think is really extremely appreciated by a lot of farmers.
Has getting that access, filling out that application, has that been streamlined and straightforward?
I found it to be extremely streamlined. I sent it to my FSA office. They immediately returned the papers. So the turnaround time for me to sign everything after they had entered it, they called with a few questions, a few clarifications of things. And then they said, okay, we're going to throw your paperwork in the mail. It'll be there. Just sign it, send it back. So I, as far as my personal experience, it was streamlined and just real easy to work with. They made it easy to work with.
We're talking with dairy farmer Linda Seeler, who's explaining how her farm is affected by the pandemic's economic fallout. She's giving us a better sense of what farmers like her are going through. How have you changed your operations? What have you learned about farming in the pandemic? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're discussing the plight of farmers in the pandemic and whether The aid is stabilizing markets and farm operations here in Wisconsin. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to an August survey of nearly 8,500 ag lenders, about one in five farm borrowers asked to restructure loans this year because of the pandemic's economic instability. And lenders are closely monitoring farm income and debt headed into 2021. Are you worried about your farm debt? Might you have to refinance to keep the farm running? Have you talked with your lenders about what you're facing? What do they say? Join in at 800-642-1234. We have organic dairy farmer Linda Seeler, who is secretary of the Wisconsin Farmers Union, and she's with us for 10 more minutes. So, Linda, you said earlier the remarks by Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue in October 2019 at the World Dairy Expo in Madison. He said, in America, the big get bigger and the small get out. How do you feel about President-elect Joe Biden's pick of Tom Vilsack for Ag Secretary?
I'd have to say that there are a few others that I had just talked with a group of farmers yesterday, and the consensus was that due to some of his leaving and going out into the corporate sector and coming back, we're kind of going to be pushing that possibly there could be a choice that could be a little bit more favorable to us. And that was a group of farmers I was speaking with that were it was on a call that was a national call, not just a local Wisconsin call, although there were several Wisconsin farmers that brought this up for discussion. So I am hoping that possibly we can have some influence, and maybe there's someone that's a little more total farm friendly.
I would imagine you want policymakers to be able to walk in your footsteps, to feel what you feel.
Absolutely. To have a feel for everyone's footsteps, whether large or small, no matter what kind of operation, I think it would be a better fit personally. And I agreed with the folks that were talking yesterday. So hopefully there's time. There were a few names thrown about that I won't really mention here,
sure.
But I think it does really, I think it really matters what the policy is from the person. And I really think we need a fresh set of eyes. After Vilsack, we just continued to hemorrhage farms. There continued to be problems. So I really think we need a fresh set of eyes on the situation and a fresh set of maybe looking outside of the box on policy. Someone that favors supply management across the board for a lot of the crops, I think that would be a good change.
Do you feel like the record number of farm bankruptcies is really worrisome to the industry as a whole?
I do. I think that part of it, if you're looking at a record number of farm bankruptcies, you're also looking at the average age of a farmer,
mm-hmm.
and the amount of problems that someone would have getting started to have access to capital, to have access to land, to have access to everything that it takes to make the operation go. I thought it was hard when I started out, and that was in the 90s because was not from a farming background. I think it is 10 times harder than I ever imagined now for people to get started and for people to stay started.
Is it those upstart costs? Is it the cost that you run into in replacing equipment? What are the biggest expenses?
Well, across the board, everything is expensive. The startup costs, I mean, land has always been something that has gone up in price. It depends on what kind of operation you're starting. Maybe you can custom hire stuff to be done for a certain amount of time until you can afford to have your own equipment. But custom hire is not inexpensive. Plus, depending on your area, if you're custom hiring to have somebody to do things, every time the weather breaks, they're all rushing to get everything done in a very small window. So that means that possibly your crop harvest could be delayed from where it's prime to maybe going down to a little bit more choice.
Variables that you just cannot control.
You can't control. I mean, you can pencil a lot of things out, but everything that everything that it goes into farming, the static costs, you've got to have a certain amount of profit to come back to pay for those things. Mm-hmm. And when you're starting out and the profits are so low that even people that have been in with a certain amount of capital for X amount of years are losing their farms, then you can understand how hard it is for a person to start out without that capital base to go ahead and continue to build on it. It's just a very, very tough time to start, and we need younger people coming in.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Linda Seeler. She's an organic dairy farmer in northern Wisconsin on the board of the Wisconsin Farmers Union, taking your insights on farming now amid the pandemic at 800-642-1234. Bob is joining us from Mauston this morning. Hi, Bob.
Hello.
Hi.
Well, the thing that I see in what she's talking about is the same thing, is that back in 1950, when I was at 4-H Club Congress, and following the war, when the United States had fed Northern Africa, part of Europe that wasn't under German control, and the Scandinavian countries, and part of Russia, and so on, afterwards, we had a surplus. And that surplus, according to the experts, is how they would get rid of it, is if we paid the farmer less, he would produce less, and they wouldn't have a surplus. This has been the program through the years. And what it is, back in the 80s, we took over the home farm, and we wanted to or needed to borrow $90,000, but we had to expand and get to almost $275,000 in borrowed money. Then the government raised the interest rate from 9% to 18%. Talking to several farmers about the same time, it made no difference if you was in the hog business, the beef business, the milk, or eggs, or any of it. This was the way that the modern industry of farming became.
The debt to expense ratio, debt to income ratio, just out of whack, I think, Bob, what you're leading to here. Linda, how would you fix milk pricing in 2020, 2021, going beyond?
I think that you need to have a supply management program. I think that if you're, for instance, if the, let's just say the price is going to go high for the year, so everybody's going to add on cows, and then we're going to oversupply, so then we're going to have the price drop again. Basically, it has been shown many times, models that we have seen done by ag experts that have shown that if you have supply management, you can milk less animals or create less crop. And because the supply is managed, you have a better idea of what you're going to get paid at the end of the whole cycle. And you also have a pay price that's more stable. It's really hard in farming to go ahead and put a crop in, or as this gentleman said, to go ahead and borrow money and be told, well, you know, you need to borrow more money. Really what you want to do is going to cost this. And if you do this, you'll be making more money. And then all of a sudden the interest rate goes up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you have no control over that. That's set by somebody else. You can't really see it coming. Obviously, if you could, you would probably be a more money market person than you would be a farmer. And granted, farming has risks. Weather's a risk. Going outside's a risk. Starting a tractor, it could be done that day. Anything's a risk. You're not guaranteed everything. But if you do have somewhat of a mechanism to stabilize your price, at least you have an idea of what you're going to be paid with a minor fluctuation, not fluctuation that means dollars per hundred or, dollars per pound or whatever else you're being paid. That's why a lot of people succeed in direct marketing, because they have more control of their price and they understand the product. You know, if you're making vegetables, you understand that, you know, my buyers are going to need X amount of broccoli. I might grow a little bit to hedge in case an insect problem happens or something else, but I'm just using that as an example.
Yeah.
That way you have an idea of what you're producing and what you're going to be paid. And it's the same way with any of the other markets. Right now, corn market is suffering because of changes in the ethanol policy and changes in the blend. These people are suffering because they put in a crop and they figured, well, okay, I can make X amount of money. Now it's down to where maybe it's break even. That's kind of tough to go out and do all that work, plant all those acres, take all that risk, and then think about, well, I might start out with what I had. And as a gentleman also said, farming is pretty much about moving money. I mean, you've got a certain amount of reservoir of money, and you're always just moving it and trying to stay ahead of it. And when all of a sudden something happens and it cascades backwards, it's really hard to pick that up. It's hard to get that momentum back. That's why I think that supply management, which is used in my co-op, I think it's an excellent tool. And it doesn't really favor anybody. It looks out for everybody that's planting, whether you're small, whether you're large, irregardless of the crop that you're growing.
Linda, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. You're welcome. And you guys have a great day.
You too. Linda Seeler operates Hillside Dairy, an organic dairy in northern Wisconsin. Coming up, we discuss the expected flight of bald eagles toward our state this year. We'll talk eagles after this news update on the Ideas Network. The Cornell Lab of Ornithology describes the bald eagle cry as high, weak-sounding, and whiny. No doubt we can look past the less-than-majestic voice of our national bird. In the winter months ahead, we're checking in on Wisconsin's bald eagle nesting population here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Have you noticed the resurgence of bald eagles where you live? Have you seen them flying around in your area or nesting in nearby trees, hunting on the lakes near your home? We're at 800-642-1234. Debbie Nowak is director and a naturalist at 1000 Lakes Environmental Center, a municipally run conservancy of more than 350 acres in Kaukauna. Debbie, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me back today.
Well, bald eagles are migrating from Canada to Wisconsin for nesting at the moment. Tell us about what these birds do here during the winter.
Sure. So just to clarify, bald eagles are definitely migrating birds. So they are short distance migrators. But the reason for their migration is really food based. So we're not in their nesting season right now. So they are migrating to find open water so they can find that favorite food source, which happens to be fish. About 90% of the eagle's diet comes from fish. So they are always seeking open water in order to be able to feed. As we all know, things get cold in the wintertime. Our lakes and our rivers are freezing over. So a lot of times they do move so they can find that food source. And lucky for us here in the Fox Valley area of Wisconsin, we have the Fox River that never completely freezes over. So the Fox Valley area becomes a destination for our wintering eagles.
Yeah, so much to their delight, they have a readily available food source even when it gets pretty brutally cold.
Absolutely. We're pretty fortunate here. There is a lot of elevation change in the Fox River. And when I talk the Fox River, I'm talking the lower portion of the Fox. So really, we consider that starting at Lake Winnebago, and then it flows north to the Bay of Green Bay. So on that lower Fox, there is a lot of elevation change, which means there's a lot of current going. There's also a lot of industry on the river, and that industry tends to help keep that water flowing. So once again, as long as our water is not covering over completely in ice, it is really an all-you-can-eat smorgasbord for those eagles. So we will see our eagle population increase quite a bit in the winter time. The population numbers do vary from winter to winter depending on the conditions. Last year, I think we were about 500 eagles in this lower Fox stretch. Right now, the eagle populations are increasing. Here at our property at Thousand Islands, you can usually see maybe a dozen to 20 eagles if you're going at the right time. So you want to try to aim for the twilight hours. That's when you're going to see them most active. So right around sunrise and right around sunset, you'll get some great eagle sightings.
What is the best way to observe eagles?
So one of the big things to remember is to not disturb the eagle populations while you're observing them. So you're going to want to find a nice spot where you have a view of the river. You're going to want to have some optics with you, a nice pair of binoculars or a spotting scope, something like that, because you do want to you want to view from a distance. So one of the things we want people to avoid is scaring the eagles. So if you see an eagle roosting in a tree, please don't walk right up to that tree. Every time a bird of prey like this has to fly to escape humans, they're wasting energy sources. The winter can be harsh. Even though we have a lot of food here, it's still a lot of cold weather. We want them to be able to use those energy reserves to feed and to maintain their health, not by escaping humans. So always observe from a distance, use binoculars or a spotting scope. Stay kind of quiet, definitely don't want to be yelling at them, and just wait for that great opportunity instead of creating one.
Debbie, what has led to their comeback in recent decades? Because the 70s were a really difficult time for the eagles, and we've seen such a resurgence.
Absolutely. So just a little bit of a recap. Back in the earlier than the 70s even, we were down to only about 500 nesting pairs of bald eagles, and that's in the continental U.S., so not including Alaska, very, very few mating pairs of eagles. So on the brink of extinction. There are a number of things that have helped that comeback. One of the biggest things is the banning of DDT. Here locally, the banning of PCBs has also had a big impact. There have been a lot of federal regulation that has protected them as well. So you cannot hunt bald eagles. You can't even possess any part of an eagle. If you find an eagle feather, you're not legally allowed to keep that. So with the government protections, with the banning of some of these chemicals that were polluting the environment, and even with a lot of just awareness amongst citizens, really appreciating this bird, becoming aware that a lot of our actions were causing some of the demise of the eagles. And, you know, once people start standing up and speaking up for a species or any issue, really, that helps that ball rolling towards their protections. So it really was a whole lot of things working together to help that come back.
When you look at the banning of those chemicals, how are those chemicals getting into the eagles and making them sick?
Great question. One of the basic laws of nature that we like to teach about is that there is no such thing as away. You can throw stuff away in your garbage can and it leaves your house, but it doesn't mean it actually ever goes anywhere. And the same thing happens with some of these chemicals that we're using. DDT, once again, as I mentioned, was this wonderful chemical that was invented. You could spray it in your yards along the beaches, and it would get rid of all the mosquitoes and it would get rid of some of the fear of the diseases that some of these insects were carrying. So people thought it was this great thing. But what we didn't realize at the time was that even though we're getting rid of the mosquitoes and now we don't see this chemical anymore, it's still out there. It's still going somewhere. So a lot of times these chemicals will wash into our waterways, our rivers, our lakes, the oceans, those sorts of things. And what it does is it becomes part of the food chain. So even if you look at the very, very bottom of the food chain, if you're looking at tiny little particles of algae, that algae gets contaminated with the chemical. It's really not a big deal. You know, we don't care all that much about algae as people, you know, so not an issue. But as you move up that food chain and you get small microscopic organisms eating the algae, and then you get, you know, small fish eating those organisms, and then you get bigger fish eating the smaller fish. And all of a sudden, when you look at the top of the food chain, the bald eagle being one of them, by the time the eagle is eating that fish, all the contamination from below that is all accumulated into that fish. So the ones at the top of the food chain are the ones that are affected the most.
Because with it's eagles, infiltrating that whole ecosystem.
Absolutely. And so it was affecting the reproductive system. They were not laying eggs. The eggs weren't hatching. They were breaking. And that was really one of the big things that caused that population to fall.
Debbie Nowak directs a Thousand Islands Environmental Center. It's a conservancy of more than 350 acres in Kakana. We're looking at our state's bald eagle population and how to best observe them, be good stewards of them. Do you think we're doing enough to create natural spaces and an acceptable habitat for eagles? Have you seen more bald eagles around the state in recent years? Are you a bird watcher? Join in at 800-642-1234. Debbie, is bald eagle poaching a problem specifically here in Wisconsin?
You know, I am not a DNR warden, so I can't give you specific statistics. It is not something we hear of a lot. It does happen, I'm sure. One of the biggest threats that we have for eagles right now is a little bit of an unintended consequence, and that's simply lead poisoning. When people are out hunting, even if they're not hunting a bald eagle, their actions can affect the bald eagles and end up killing them. A lot of our hunting ammunition these days is lead-based. And when a hunter, for instance, goes out, legally shoots a deer, sometimes those bullet fragments will be left off in the environment. If it's left in a gut pile, which is very commonly left out in the woods, and an eagle feeds on that gut pile, just the smallest amount of lead is enough to kill an adult bald eagle. So although, you know, outright poaching probably isn't a huge factor in this area, the lead poisoning definitely is.
I want to look at celebrating Eagle Days, which is part of your center's work. How are you working around the pandemic to still hold this event this year?
That has been the million-dollar question these days. So we do hold an Eagle Day celebration on the fourth Saturday of every January. So we will be doing that on January 23rd, this next January. And we will hold it in a pandemic-safe way. We are going to be releasing some of those details next week. But I can tell you we're working with the National Eagle Center, who usually brings a live eagle to our event and does some programming. We're going to do virtual programming with them as well, so people can safely view the program from their homes. And then a lot of what we do at the Eagle Day celebration is encouraging people to get outside and view eagles. And thankfully, for us, it is safe to get outside. So you can get outside with your family group. We'll have some volunteers that will kind of point you in the right direction and spend some time viewing the wild eagles that we have here at Thousand Islands.
You know, besides where you are in the Fox River area, where are some other great places to spot eagles in our state?
So if you are looking in, you know, the spring, summer, fall, really anywhere throughout the state, there are eagles and even occupied eagle nests in almost every single county of the state. So you can really go anywhere, find some water, bring some binoculars, and you'll find some. In the wintertime, you want to seek out that open water. The Fox River area, southwestern Wisconsin, is also good viewing near the Mississippi River. So you definitely want to find those open water sources to find the eagles in the wintertime.
Bald eagles, they are doing well. We have Debbie Nowak, who is our guide to bald eagles, and she directs the Thousand Islands Environmental Center in Kakana. Have you seen more bald eagles around the state in recent years? Are you a bird watcher? Do you plan to attend virtual events like Eagle Days or Bald Eagle Watching Days in Prairie du Sac next month? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about bald eagles and how best to observe them. Have you watched bald eagles along the lower Wisconsin River? Do you have photographs you're proud of? What can you share about eagles in your area? It's 800-642-1234. Debbie Nowak of 1000 Islands Environmental Center in Kakana is with us for 10 more minutes. Let's bring in Denny, who is joining us from Ogdensburg. Hi, Denny.
Good morning. Thanks for the show. A couple points. I live in Waupaca County, love the eagles, and I'm an outdoorsman, paddler, hunter, fisherman, and I see them regularly. It's not a surprise. Obviously, they feed in a lot of car-killed deer and other things, but we have mature eagles and immature eagles battling the flambeau last fall. Watched a pair of geese and their young hiding under an overextended limb over the river, and here was an eagle eyeing them for lunch if they decided to come out.
Oh, boy.
Interesting to watch. But my question is anybody talking about 30 for 30, setting 30% of the land and wilderness aside by 2030 for the betterment of humans and eagles and other species?
Denny, thank you.
Oh, thanks for the question, Denny. As far as the 30 for 30 goes, that is something a little out of our jurisdiction here at the Nature Center. That would be an excellent question for the DNR, though. If you look on the DNR's website under Eagles, there is a great contact there that you can reach out and check that out. But I am not familiar with that program here.
Debbie, let's look more about your environmental center covering, 350 acres, trails, a lot of options there to be able to be in nature. How are you preserving your conservancy and making sure that it's the best habitat it can be for eagles and other birds?
Well, I think one of the biggest things is the fact that this property has actually been set aside as conservancy zone. That means, the city can't decide next year to sell it and subdivide it and build houses, that sort of thing. So it's been preserved, very similar to that, what it sounds like that 30 for 30 is we really just need to make sure we have designated property to remain natural habitat that supports our natural environment, it supports our wildlife, and all of that in turn supports us as a society as well. So that's our biggest thing. Other things that we are doing, we work with a lot of different organizations in order to kind of study what's going on in the environment. We've been working with a local university, Lawrence University, studying our bat populations here. We're partnering with Madison Audubon Society to study, the eagle nests here as well. So partnering with those other organizations, giving a place to do research has been very beneficial. And then our overall goal, or I should say one of our overall goals, is to try to really preserve natural ecosystems. Thousand Islands, like a lot of different natural areas, is, threatened with invasive species. We have a lot of buckthorn on the property. We have a lot of garlic mustard. We have some new ones coming in, like barberry and phragmites. So we're really trying to think outside of the box and find creative ways to battle these invasive species to preserve that native habitat that we should have here along the Fox River.
You mentioned the Madison Audubon Society and working with them on a bald eagle nest monitoring project. What is this about?
So this is something that is brand new for us, and it'll be starting in 2021. But Madison Audubon, back in 2018, started working with the DNR, and they do citizen science projects. So they recruit volunteers, and all these volunteers get assigned with a known eagle nest in the area. Those volunteers will go out about once a week during their nesting season. So really thinking February through June, and keep an eye on the nest to look for activity. Are the eagles building on the nest? Are the eagles sitting on eggs? Can we see any of the eaglets in the nest? When do they fledge? The DNR only has so many staff members, so relying on volunteers to gather this data has been great. So this year, we are expanding to the Fox Valley area. This week, we just went and did some scouting, and we are thinking we are going to be monitoring probably around 9 nests in the area here just to help gather that data on, how many of these eagles are successful in their nesting season.
How many might be in that nest? What is that nest like?
So the nests are actually quite impressive. If you've ever seen a bald eagle nest, they can be 4 to 5 feet across, 4 to 5 feet deep, and they get bigger each year. So they're really, really massive nests. They are used year after year, as long as it's a safe and successful location for those eagles. And then they are laying eggs around here, usually about March, early to mid-March, and they will lay 1 to 3 eggs. And then we hope they'll have, 1 to 3 eaglets that will eventually grow to fledge or take that first flight out of the nest. It's a hard life out there in the wild, though. So even if you have 3 eggs hatch, you don't necessarily have 3 eaglets that make it to, juveniles to fly out of the nest. And then even if they get out of the nest, there's a 70% mortality rate for raptors in their first year. So it's a hard life. So the more we can do to understand it and protect them, the better off we are.
Well, it's good to hear that they're not having to rebuild their nests over and over, if possible. What do they make their nests out of?
The majority of the nest is built out of sticks, and then they will line that with grasses, moss, whatever soft materials they can find.
So when you're looking at your trail maintenance at a Thousand Islands Environmental Center, what goes into that? How do you maintain your trails and certainly keep people on them?
You know, one of the biggest things is relying on volunteers to help us with that. I just met with a couple of volunteers yesterday that they're going to work on clearing out a portion of our trail from some of the buckthorn. We are a very small staff here, so we only have, right now we only have three staff members, four when we're fully staffed. So we do rely on volunteers a lot to do that. And as I mentioned before, we rely on creativity a little bit. One of the ways that we've been tackling buckthorn and other invasives in the past couple of years is we have been bringing goats onto the property. Goats will come out and eat all of the vegetation, and we do this repeatedly. And by eating the vegetation down multiple times, we'll eventually kind of get rid of the energy source in their root system, and those plants will die back enough for our native plants to grow.
We're talking with Debbie Nowak, who's a naturalist, heads up a Thousand Islands Environmental Center. We're discussing the success of the bald eagle population in Wisconsin, where we go from here in terms of conservation and habitat. So, Debbie, those goats are really helping you keep some of that non-native vegetation in check.
It is. Yeah, we have a small little, we call it our test area, where we're experimenting with this method. And in this small area, it's been working really well. Not only to help battle those invasive species, but it really is helping to spread awareness and education, because everybody loves coming down to see the goats. And while they're here, we can throw a little information their way and they understand a little bit more about the importance of having native vegetation versus all of the invasive stuff here.
You know, the city of Kaukauna is an official bird city. What does that mean? And how can other communities become, you know, better stewards of birds?
Sure. So yeah, we're very proud of our Bird City designation. Many people are probably familiar with Tree City USA, if your community, you know, does a lot of good things for trees. This is kind of modeled after that. So to be a Bird City, you have to meet certain criteria that you are creating sustainable and proper habitat to support our bird populations. So the fact that we have our 350-acre conservancy zone here is a huge, huge part of that. Our Eagle Day celebration is our annual educational event that we do for that. So a lot of things go into it. You know, Bird City is a great opportunity for, once again, to have some of these ideas visible to the general public. The more people are aware, oh, I didn't realize that, you know, if I plant some native wildflowers in my backyard, that's going to be a lot better for the birds and the habitat than if I have all grass in my backyard. So just kind of getting those ideas out there. And the more people understand the concept behind this of creating and preserving habitat, for birds, the better off we're going to be. And we love it when people get excited about seeing the birds. Mm. So as we encourage people to, you know, have bird-friendly backyards, attend events, come birding down on the property, the more you know, the more you're going to love them. The more you love them, the more you're going to protect them.
Debbie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Debbie Nowak, 1,000 Islands Environmental Center, a conservancy of more than 350 acres in Kaukauna. Just ahead, we examine homelessness around our state amid the pandemic and what outreach is making headway with this problem. We talk with three people who work on trying to remedy homelessness every day. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.